And our sermon text is Job 1, 6 to 12. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out in the presence of the Lord. In my very first pastoral call, I was an associate to a more experienced senior man, and he gave me the responsibility for counseling, among other things. And I quickly discovered that most people seek a counselor, whether for marriage or emotional problems or any other reason, when they have exhausted all other possibilities. It's usually too late to solve that problem. So I asked my boss whether he had given me this responsibility to save him grief or to hone my pastoral skills. "Yes," was all he said, winking at me. Now, most people end up in court for the same reasons. All else has failed. Nerves are frayed, tensions are high, tempers are short. The litigants are usually implacable foes by the time the suit reaches a judge's bench. The lawyer Melvin Stamper titled one of his books, "A Lawsuit is an Act of War." A lawsuit is an act of war. The thing is, no one comes out unscathed, even if you're in the right. Voltaire said, "I was never ruined, but twice. Once when I lost a lawsuit and once when I won one." The process is long and grueling and expensive, and it takes its toll on everybody involved. Ambrose Bierce, a wise old wag, defines a lawsuit as this: a machine where you go in as a pig and come out as a sausage. So fair warning. Deb and I were defendants in a lawsuit. It was in small claims court, so fortunately it wasn't too bad. In Teton County, soon after we moved into the area, some of you know the story, right? You were with us during that period of our lives. We won, but after almost $5,000 in lawyer and legal fees, this Italian proverb resonated with us. A lawsuit is a fruit tree planted in a lawyer's garden. A lawsuit is a fruit tree that keeps on producing, doesn't it? Planted in a lawyer's garden. And that, of course, in addition to the stress and anxiety that goes along with a lawsuit. Now, we are about to enter into a cosmic lawsuit on the model of the patriarchal lawsuit in ancient times. Those of you that have been with us the last few weeks, you know we've been introducing this to you. However, I dare say that any defendant in redemptive history, save one, has endured as much as the figure we are about to join. Save one, right? We're not just in this for a rollicking good tale, although it is a rollicking good tale at the same time. Job's prosecutor is none other than Satan himself, and his judge is none other than Yahweh, the God of the Bible himself. Now, this is in part why it has consequences for redemptive history. It's not just an apology for why the righteous suffer, nor is it a mere theodicy for God either, although it is both of those things, impacts both of those areas. Now, if that is all that is at stake, an apology for God or an explanation of why the righteous suffer, then the cynics and the scoffers of the Bible, in general, and of Job in particular, are correct. God is treating Job, as one atheist said in a debate that I listened to a while back, God is treating Job like the sadist who pins a fly to paper and pulls off his wings and legs to see him suffer. Now, that's a pretty crass unbeliever's perspective, even at that. But to such men and to such commentators, Dr. Meredith Klein says this. He says, how undiscerning is the exegesis that sees here only what is described with supercilious profanity. I like that description. Supercilious profanity as, and then he quotes one of these unbelieving skeptics who is also a commentator on the Interpreter's Bible, how they ever make it into commentating on the Bible with any seriousness, I don't know. But he says, the idea of God, of a God who allows human suffering for the purpose of winning a heavenly wager. That's the reductio ad absurdum that this supercilious, profane man has come to. But we will also see that in ways beyond the superficial, that our defendant, Job, is also supported and destined by providence to be acquitted of all the charges and vindicated as Exhibit A thus far in redemptive history, as the seed of the woman who crushes the head of the serpent and defeats his seed, the serpent's seed. If you're looking for absolute simplicity in the book of Job, you're in the wrong book. Job is a very complex book, but it is an understandable book when you have some of the interpretive keys. And I want to alert you to those here in the this message and subsequent ones as well. So let's examine more closely today the litigants of this patriarchal lawsuit, because this is what it is, a patriarchal lawsuit in the heavenly realms. Let's look to point one. First of all, the litigants. In the majestic court of heaven, the great judge requires an accounting from the sons of God regarding the progress of redemption. This is in verses 6 and 7. You have an outline. You have a brief outline in the inside flap of your bulletin if you want to follow along, help you make sense of the text as well. The scene takes place in the majestic court of heaven, and here the great judge requires an accounting from the sons of God regarding the progress of redemption, verses 6 and 7. Now, the scene unfolded before us today is all important. It's the backdrop for all that transpires henceforth. From here on in, Job is a long book, too. Regardless of the speaker speaking or the vivid scene being portrayed in eloquent poetry, which Job is as well, eloquent, beautiful Hebrew poetry, the immediate scene is established here. The immediate scene is established here. No matter how intense and immediate may be the times and travails of Job and his interlocutors, the setting remains here. The eyes, ears, and presence of those depicted here, figurative, of course, in the case of God, this is the primary audience of the trial. You and I, as readers, are the secondary audience. When we get down to the weeds and the hurly-burly of Job's life and the suffering and so forth, it's going to be hard to keep this in mind. But remember always that this is the primary scene we are unfolding here today. It is theopocentric, not andropocentric. That is, it is God-centered, not man-centered. Well, the two-tiered nature of the universe into which we are thrust is flagged by the introduction. Now there was a day. Cast your eyes back to verse 1. Now there was a man, right? Our scene shifts from earth to heaven. Heaven, the unseen realm of the spiritual reality. Takes us back to Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Here we are taken to the heavens. The notion of a day. There was a day also does not equate to a literal 24-hour period of sidereal time. There's no such thing in heaven undemarcated by the movements of our sun and moon. A day here merely refers to a figurative point in the reality of that realm. It's much like Peter describes day in his letter, but do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as one day. Well, upon this appointed time, then, the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh. The sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh. The sons of God. What does this mean, the sons of God? It's in the plural, first of all, remark. Ezekiel is called a son of God, and of course there is the son of God, singular, both, but the sons of God, here, plural, has a broad, comprehensive understanding of all those created beings formed directly by the hand of God. Okay? Broad, comprehensive understanding of all those created beings formed directly by the hand of God. We indeed are sons of God, created in Christ, but we are immediately born through mothers and fathers, right? It's one of the miracles. We are co-creators with God in that sense, in that we can create little ones as well. Co-creators made immediately, but still sons of God. But the sons of God, as it's used here, all those created beings formed directly by the hand of God. Several examples. We have angels of all rank. David says he makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire, which Hebrews quotes in chapter 1. And Paul asserts that the risen Christ is far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, very technical names for created heavenly beings and angels, and above every name that is named not only in this age but also in the one to come. Sons of God also describe fallen angels of all rank. Genesis 6 tells us when man began to multiply in the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive and they took as their wives any they chose. Fallen angels of all rank are also sons of God. Then there are the myriads of creatures. Heaven is filled with myriads of creatures. We'll marvel at this when we are translated. From Genesis to Revelation, we have descriptions of vast numbers of created beings. For example, from Ezekiel 1. As I looked, Ezekiel, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north and a great cloud with brightness around it and fire flashing forth continually in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures, sons of God. That is, those beings created directly by the hand of God. Heaven is filled with them. And all inhabitants, then, of this invisible realm are as well consequently under the rubric of sons of God, and they are created, not created without purpose either. Each son of God has a place in the redemptive purpose of God, and each has a responsibility in accord with that purpose. We see this throughout Scripture. Angels of the Old Testament, whether defending Lot or Joshua or Elisha, responsible, purposes, accountable. Angels frustrating the purpose of Balaam or slaying the Assyrians or being a lying spirit in the mouth of all of Ahab's prophets. All of these were created with a purpose and a responsibility and were accountable to God. All have a place and time and purpose in the redemptive scheme of God. The four living creatures who emblemize God's omnipresence and omniscience In the vision of God in Ezekiel 1, I just cited for you, they have a redemptive purpose. They have responsibilities in accord with that purpose, and they are accountable to God. Well, all of these are sons of God insofar as they were created directly, immediately by the hand of God and not through the mediary of the procreation of the creature. Each must therefore give a periodic accounting for their behavior. That is the sense of the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. They're not there for show. They're not there to strut their stuff for everybody else. They're not there for some kind of Alice in Wonderland tea party in their court finery. Every created being in the universe will give an account of himself to God, as Paul says. And in fact, do you not know that we are to judge angels? The majestic pageant of redemptive history is taking its course. We see that Job is indeed part of that redemptive history in the patriarchal period, isn't it? It's part of the accounting of redemptive history, the marking of redemptive history in the patriarchal period, that time between Noah and Abraham. This majestic pageant of redemptive history is taking its course. From time to time, every creature involved must account for his role and purpose and actions in it. This is what is encapsulated in that brief phrase, the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan, as rebellious and contrary as he is no exception. He too is nevertheless a creature serving the purpose of his Creator. This is the sense in which he is a son of God. He too must give an account, as infernal and blasphemous as it may be. Reminds me of the advice of the Godfather he gave to Michael. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Satan's accountability is implicit in God's inquiry. From where have you come? From where have you come? It's no idle, friendly banter meant to ease the tension of the fall and rebellion, right? God's not chilling, asking, hey, dude, what's happening? It's a demand. Account for your whereabouts and activity. Satan's compelled testimony is from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. You see him, can't you? From going to and fro, from walking up and down out. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. As Peter says, he knows his turf, and momentarily he thinks he may have a fresh victim, right? Now this brief vignette, as we pursue to the end of verse 12, will show us several things regarding Satan. Two things I want to point out to you right now. His attributes are finite. Satan's attributes are finite. He's not omnipotent, omniscient, nor omnipresent. He must scour the earth to exercise his power, acquire his knowledge, and find his place. And secondly, always remember, he is a creature. He is a creation of God for a purpose, for a redemptive purpose. He is a creature who must give account to God after all. Luciferianism is bubbling up again. It has in every decaying and dying culture. All those who follow Lucifer and his many namesakes, Baal, Beelzebub, Helios, and the many names by which he goes, are deceived into thinking he is the real God, the real light, the real power. But he is not only the accuser and adversary, he is also the deceiver. So, with these things in mind, let us observe how the history of redemption progresses in the plan of God as he initiates its advance. God is here initiating the advance of redemptive history. This is not just idle talk and idle banter that God stumbles into. Okay? Point two, then, verses 8 to 11. The litigants in the majestic court of heaven, the great judge highlights Job as exhibit A in the progress of redemption, to whom Satan brings suit. To whom Satan brings suit, that is, against Job. Very economical account that we have here. Thought to be perhaps an early parable that was expanded upon over the centuries. But here at this portion, at this juncture, out of the limitless possibilities God could have brought forward, he isolates upon his servant Job. His servant Job. And note that it is God who initiates that achievement, which will issue in a trial by ordeal to prove and test that achievement. And I call Job God's achievement. Job is God's achievement. That is, he is exhibit A in the progress of redemption. He is a type of him who will crush the head of the serpent. Job is not a mere bauble of happenstance that God plucks from the otherwise rotting stench of humanity. Hey, look what I found. Job is not some random diamond formed by the intense forces of nature and the inevitable upward progress of evolution that God holds up and exclaims, "Behold the wonders of natural selection." That's not Job. God does not happen upon Job. Job is a deliberate trophy of grace, distinguished by three marks. Number one, there's none like him on the earth. God has been specially husbanding Job as a type of him who will come. Secondly, Job is blameless and upright. Job is blameless and upright. Now that echoes and confirms what we saw last week, right? Those of you that were here with us last week. And if you wonder what it means to be blameless and upright, consult that sermon. But just let me summarize that to be blameless and upright is that Job is covenantally faithful, and he's complete in his integrity. He's not sinless. He's not an exception to Adam's fallen nature, but he is covenantally faithful, and he is complete in his integrity. And this is consistent, as we'll see, all the way through Job. Job never loses this. He is blameless and upright all through his experiences. And then thirdly, Job is biblically wise. Job is biblically wise. We saw last week that these two attributes, that is, Job being a God-fearer and one who eschews evil, that these two things mark true wisdom. Consult Job 28:28. Easy to remember, Job 28:28. He said to man, "Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding." That's biblical wisdom. In summary, Job is this. So, despite the curse of Genesis 3, all is not lost. Despite the sin and misery, which is the lot of Adam's seed, redemption draweth nigh. Still a ways off, but draweth nigh. Although the seed of the serpent is and will bruise the heel of the woman's seed, this seed will crush the serpent's head in eventuality. Job is a type of that seed, and he's a link in his fruition, just as Abraham and David and Solomon and Noah before him were types of the one to come. Job is one of these. He anticipates, he foreshadows Christ, especially in his suffering. And that battle is being played out in miniature here in the book of Job, and we are privy to its initiation. God has initiated it. He is sovereign in all that he does. Well, the trap's been set. Will the dog return to his vomit? Will the bird trip the snare? Will the kid take the candy? Bingo! Satan takes it, doesn't he? How did God know? Satan takes the bait. He brings the formal indictment that triggers the lawsuit in heaven. Satan brings the indictment, he brings the indictment that triggers the lawsuit in heaven. Takes the form. This entire book takes the form of a patriarchal lawsuit. He brings the charge. Does Job fear God for no reason? Does Job fear God for no reason? This is the indictment that triggers the lawsuit from which all the action of Job flows. He doesn't ask, why do good men suffer? He doesn't ask, you deserve an apology, a theodicy for why men suffer. No. Satan brings the charge, does Job fear God for no reason? That is, Job doesn't have implicit faith in you and love for you. No, you've bought his loyalty. He's not a trophy of grace, but a product of works, a cynical con man of quid pro quo. That is, he's good because you bless him. You lavish him with a fenced life. You pour in blessings of health and strength and prosperity. He doesn't serve you and fear you because he has implicit faith and love for you. No. The particular proofs of his case, he says, you protect him in all that he has, right? And secondly, you practice a gospel of health and wealth with him. You might as well be Joel Osteen, God, because you bless him with health and wealth. Keep in mind, as we go through Job, and as his trials pour down upon him, and we sift and go through them all, we'll get, you know, from about chapter 3 until chapter 38, we'll be consumed with his suffering. Just keep in mind as we do so, that he's being tried. He's a champion of God, if you will. The proposed mode of trial of the issue is a trial by ordeal. A trial by ordeal. That's strange to us. Started to wane in the Middle Ages. But it was indeed very real in the ancient days. And we'll see. You'll be surprised at how many trials by ordeals the Bible is chock full of. The proposed mode of trial of the issue that is testing to see whether this is true or no is a trial by ordeal. Take down your hedge of protection and let me destroy all that he has. And then, when he curses you to your face, which was an egregious form of blasphemy, after which there can be no question and no repentance, after he curses you to your face, my point will have been made, my case will have been won, right? That's the proposed mode of trial to determine the issue. Now we have to place ourselves back in the ancient patriarchal mindset. Understand a trial by ordeal was a divine means of distinguishing the righteous from the wicked, to distinguish those upon whom God favored over those upon whom he spent his wrath. And there were three primary forms of trial by ordeal. Those of you in the Sunday school class, you know these, right? Because we go through them every other prophet, every other book of the Bible. First, there's trial by water. The most notable trial by water by which God determines the righteous from the sinner, those upon whom he has his favor, those who, upon whom he has his curse, is the flood, right? Noah and his family, eight in all, were righteous and they experienced God's favor. The rest, blub, blub, right? Then there's trial by fire. God determines who is righteous, who is sinner, upon whom his blessing is, upon whom his curse is, in a trial by fire. Who might that be? How about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, huh? In the book of Daniel. Classic trial by fire. Who does God favor? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In the midst of the fire that was heated seven times hotter than normal, what happened to the poor saps who threw them in? Right? They were consumed. They were burned. Crisp. Paul says our works will be tried by fire. Another trial by fire. Our works as Christians will be tried by fire. Wood, hay, stubble will be consumed. Gold, silver, gems will be preserved. And then Peter says, eventually all of creation will be tried by fire. The beginning of creation, a trial by water. The end of creation, trial by fire. And then the third one is trial by combat. Aha, this is where we are with Job. Trial by combat. Let's see. Trial by combat, anybody? David and Goliath, perhaps? Trial by, on whom was God's favor? David or Goliath? And of course, ultimately, we will come right in the middle, trial by water, trial by fire, right in the middle, trial by combat, Christ at the cross. This is an anticipation of Christ's suffering with Job in his trial by combat. It is the trial ensued by Satan's accusation, and now will be played out on the stage of history in the life of Job. And here, consequently, we also have the reason for Job's suffering, don't we? We have the reason for Job's suffering. He doesn't know it yet, but man, he will soon. Job is being about to be tried by ordeal to discover whether he fears God from implicit faith and love when he has everything stripped away. All he has left, the only thing with which he can fear God, is his implicit faith and love as an object of God's grace. Will this be the case? Or does Job fear God for what he can get in a quid pro quo deal? It's also why Job never finds out. Never, does he, in the course of the book from beginning to end, never finds out why he's suffering. That's pathos. My heart bleeds for him, if you will. Job is suffering. His suffering must be discreet, though. It must be discreet and unknown to the participants below, especially Job, lest by his knowledge of it, he merely rides it out, right, for the duration, anticipating blessing at the other end for his steadfastness. That would Satan could bring that charge of just cynical quid pro quo. That has answers for us. That has answers for us. Because it gives us the short answer, why do the righteous suffer? It is thus. There are purposes for suffering which are unknown to the sufferers. That's true throughout history. We'll be taking example after example after example. It may be true in your life. There are purposes for suffering which are unknown to the sufferers. Maybe at the present time, but are nevertheless not without purpose and full of glory and blessing. Job's suffering is full of glory and blessing. He doesn't know it. He doesn't see it played out in the panoply of heaven. But it's there. It's real, nevertheless. And we can bring this to those who suffer. There are purposes for your suffering, brother, which are unknown to you at the present time, but nevertheless are not without purpose, and they are full of glory and blessing. You must trust this, as Job trusted. So this book is filled with comfort for the sufferer, but it's not the primary purpose of the book. Is to give comfort for those who are suffering. It is to encourage steadfastness, even as Peter said, right? He said, look at Job's steadfastness. He didn't say, look at his endurance and suffering. Look at his steadfastness. He clung to God when there was nothing else to cling to. No blessing, no children, no health, no strength. Only his implicit faith and love for this God. That's the short answer. Short answers, however, are cold comfort, aren't they, to the sufferer? They must be fleshed out with love and compassion, and that will do as well. Flesh out human suffering and do it with love and compassion. There are two perspectives on suffering. There's armchair suffering and wheelchair suffering, as one wag noted. There is armchair suffering and there's wheelchair suffering, those who are going through the suffering. This book ministers to them. Job is for those in the midst of arm or wheelchair suffering. Well, no trial proceeds without the consent and the oversight of the judge. And that brings us to point three. The litigants. We have been introduced to the litigants, haven't we? God Almighty, Satan the adversary, and Job. What company, huh? Litigants. In the majestic court of heaven, the great judge ordains a lawsuit to try the steadfastness of Job via a trial by ordeal and prosecuted by Satan. Verse 12. Well, permission to convene a lawsuit on the patriarchal model is granted by the judge. Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Yeah, it's also qualified, isn't it? A qualified trial. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. The accuser tries only at the grant and permission and limitations of the judge. Well, game on, right? I hope you understand by now that this is not a heavenly wager. Trivialized, supercilious profanity. This is not a heavenly wager made by two petty beings of equal strength, as some commentators try to maintain. Supercilious profanity, that is. Rather, Job is a proof of God's grace. Job is a proof of God's grace at this juncture in redemptive history. Job is a milestone in the patriarchal era. Within the limits and boundaries of the patriarchal era, we don't have Abraham, Moses, much less Christ yet. So within the limits and boundaries of the patriarchal era, we have a proof of God's grace, a milestone on the way to the cross. Can God so work grace in a man's life that he fears him out of love and faith when he has nothing else? Everything else has been stripped away. Can he fear God out of mere love and faith as Adam did originally? Or does man fear him with a wink and a nod, knowing he does so for reward in a quid pro quo fashion, even as Adam betrayed God and gave his loyalty to Satan, because he would indeed be blessed. Even Satan, what does Satan do when he tempts Christ? He says, fall down and worship me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth because they're mine to give. That's a quid pro quo relationship, isn't it? So in this way, Job is every man writ large. You are in his place. As he goes, so goes the race to this point. If Job succeeds, God succeeds in his plan of redemption thus far, and Satan fails. If Job fails and curses God to his face, God fails in his plan of redemption thus far, and Satan succeeds. Are we biting our nails, wondering who's going to win and who's not, right? No. But we see, indeed, redemption and salvation played out on the stage of the patriarchal era in this fashion. As Abraham will play out his, Moses his, Israel theirs, and Christ his. So the larger backdrop to Job then is this, is the covenant of redemption, the covenant of grace as it's called sometimes. Is it efficacious? Is God powerful to save? Is that covenant of redemption going on apace? Is it in force as God declared in Genesis 3? The seed of the woman will crush your head. Seed of the serpent will bruise his heel. How will God's champion, and in this regard, in this lawsuit, Job is God's champion in this trial by combat. How will he perform? How will Job perform? Well, stay tuned, okay? Stay tuned until next week and weeks subsequent as we see this beautiful champion of God, this marvelous token of God's grace, this type of our Lord Jesus Christ in his suffering, as this is all played out then in his life. But for now, let us come to that place where we see the ultimate champion of God, who has vindicated the gospel in his own body and blood. Let's see him in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.